Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the latest Supreme Court ruling, as well as the much-anticipated decision on the Obama healthcare reform law. Former White House counsel and Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States, John Dean, joins us. A best-selling author, his latest book is Broken Government: How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative, and Judicial Branches. Then we'll look into the president's energy tour and his visit today to Cushing, Oklahoma, where the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline he just approved begins. Jamie Henn, the co-founder with Bill McKibben of 350.org, joins us. He and Bill McKibben have been leading the fight to stop the Keystone pipeline that will carry oil from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, to refineries in Texas. Then an expert on terrorists, Mia Bloom, joins us to examine the methods and motivation of the alleged Al-Qaeda French Algerian terrorist who killed three children, a rabbi, and three paratroopers and was shot dead today by a police sniper after wounding three police officers. Mia Bloom is the author of Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror, and Bombshell, Women and Terror. And joining us now is John Dean, who is the former counsel to Richard Nixon, and prior to that was the chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the associate director of the Law Reform Commission, and associate deputy attorney general of the United States. Today, John Dean is a best-selling author who writes on the law, government, and politics. His latest book is Broken Government: How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative, and Judicial Branches. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Dean.
Ian, it's good to be with you.
And John, this ruling that came down yesterday from the Supreme Court, allowing criminal defendants or granting criminal defendants a constitutional right to effective lawyers during plea negotiations, given that now in federal courts, plea negotiations comprise 90% of all convictions. And in 2006, the last year of for which data was available, the corresponding percentage in state courts is 94%. So I'm surprised that that the four people voted against it, because it seems to be an acknowledgement of reality.
You shouldn't be surprised at that four holding the line for prosecutors, the four being obviously the right wing of the court. And the swing vote, Kennedy obviously shows he has a conscience, because the plea bargaining phase has become the end of the route. And there, as the court pointed out, there are many instances when representation is less than adequate for that phase of the proceeding. While there certainly, a judge can observe what's happening in a courtroom and see a lawyer who's not doing a good job for his client. In the plea bargaining phase, there's no lawyer there or judge there, just the lawyers and the prosecutors hashing it out. And they have some pretty egregious examples in the opinion that led them to the decision they reached.
Well, Justice Kennedy wrote that plea bargaining is not some adjunct to the criminal justice system. It is the criminal justice system. I mean, that the percentage of 97% in federal courts and 94% in state courts, that's the de facto reality.
What prosecutors do is they stack up as much they can in an indictment to try to tell the potential defendant that that's what they're going to do. They're going to charge him with this, that, and everything else. To try to force him into that plea situation. They don't want to go to court on these charges. And so they the way they fashion indictments, where you take one activity and apply a number of statutes to it, you can really make it pretty uncomfortable for that defendant. And so this is often the best of a bad world for somebody who's broken the law, giving all of the power, if you will, to the prosecutors in this negotiating process.
So then why do you think the conservatives objected to it if they're so pro-prosecutor?
No, they did. They didn't object. Scalia and Thomas and the chief and the rest of them were all, and they didn't like this decision. They voted against changing the law. They thought the plea negotiations should just, the prosecutors should have at it. They don't like the change that Kennedy's vote swung over to the other way, saying that there should be representation at this phase and good representation.
Oh, I see. Because that's what the understanding is, that it's really about how so often the councils don't. This is if all of the decisions are done through plea bargaining and not through a trial, then the plea bargaining itself is the critical point for a defense attorney to be present.
It is the beginning, middle, and end for 97% in the federal system and 94% in the state system. So it's the game, and the game never changes.
So my thought was that perhaps that Scalia and Thomas and Alito and Roberts were sort of ideologues living in a kind of ivory tower. But you're saying no, they actually liked the system before this rule came down yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it favored the prosecutors
Scalia says you've created a whole new jurisprudence of plea bargaining. And he says, you know, we've just opened a Pandora's box, as he sees it. There will be endless litigation on this issue. He's probably right. But it's also the fair way to deal with a process that really there has been egregious misuse by prosecutors. And seldom does it, you know, it's a tough game they play. They want to keep criminals off the street. When they get them, they throw the book at them. And it's not a terribly fair proceeding. It certainly doesn't have any of the checks and balances you have when you have a full trial.
But isn't it true that because the Republicans have controlled the executive branch for more time than the Democrats have in the recent decades, that they've managed to put more conservative judges on the federal bench at all levels, and that in general, the judiciary in this country is more conservative than it is, in quotes, liberal?
You're absolutely right, Ian. And not only have they done it, they've made it a priority. They've made it something that's very important. Their congressional arm does their best to block Democrats from filling judicial appointments. And then they hit, you know, I was surprised that Obama, when he arrived, wasn't more ready for this. Republicans, typically by the time they arrive in the White House, boy, they've got their list going and they hit the ground running. That hasn't been the case with the Obama administration, and they've had other priorities, so they've let a lot of this obstructionism in this area prevail as well. The Democrats are obviously hoping that they will have a president get reelected, and they'll be able to fill some of the vacancies. There's a conspicuous number of vacancies in courts right now in the federal system because of this obstructionism.
Well, it's not just a question, though, John Dean, of President Obama getting reelected. The Democrats would have to pick up a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate to move all of those blocked federal judgeships.
Well, theoretically, they still haven't put. There is really no agreement that you can filibuster a nomination and a presidential appointment. This is considered part of the executive calendar of the Senate. And while there have been filibusters, and we had some pretty near calls on it in the past, it's more stalling techniques, less than a filibuster.
Right, the holds,
The holds, and it's just pure obstructionism to tie the process up, to not report it out of committee, to tie it up at every phase. To prevent the Republican or prevent a Democratic president from balancing that bench, but you know, if just sheer time with the turnover in the federal system, the federal court system, a Democratic president will be able to balance it out. So that you know, if a man gets a 4-year term, it's close. He can't do a whole lot, and certainly not the last year. The obstructionism will even raise higher. But if Obama gets 8 years. He'll have a chance to balance out the federal judiciary, and it is out of balance right now. Bush did a good job of loving the court and tilting it to the right.
Again, I'm speaking with John Dean, who's a former counsel to President Richard Nixon. And prior to that, he was chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives and associate director of the Law Reform Commission and associate deputy attorney general of the United States. He's a best-selling author. His latest book is Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative and Judicial Branches. So the big anticipation, of course, is the ruling on the constitutionality of President Obama's health care reform law. The part that I don't understand is how it could be an issue and why people are, the pundits are saying this could totally gut the president's singular achievement, legislative achievement here, because on the basis of the mandate. But if you really look at the text of this bill, apparently, people are encouraged, shall we say, to have insurance. But there really aren't any penalties. There are no enforceable penalties.
There's nominal cash.
Yeah, no liens or anything like that. No. So couldn't you make the argument that it's really not an enforced mandate?
Well, there will be a preliminary argument as to whether it is a tax or not, and even whether it's appealable at this point, because the tax, you cannot, in essence, there's law that says you can't contest a tax until it's actually imposed. So if they rule it's a tax, or the equivalent of a tax, and it's not been imposed, there's an argument that it's not even ripe for consideration by the high court. That'll be one of the issues that the court will address, because they put it on the agenda. But there are lots of other issues. It's very interesting. I have a number of column colleagues at Justia, where we write now.
Oh, tell me that website, because I want to...
It's justia.com.
J-U-S-T-I-A.com.
Right.
Okay.
And the section is verdict. It's typically the column of the day is put on the front page, and that'll take you back to the verdict section. That's what they call the section where we do our columns. Anyway, a number of those, my co-columnists, are former Supreme Court law clerks who really follow the tea leaves very closely of that court. And off the record, they tell me they believe that Obama's going to prevail, that the court will not overturn it. And they understand and watch these issues and their nuances much more closely than I do. Which I found very interesting. In fact, one of them told me he saw a possibility of only one vote against the president. It could be an 8-1, but he said for political reasons alone that might not happen. But he thinks that at least 6-3 is a very realistic vote on upholding the Obamacare law.
Well, you get the impression that Mitt Romney's kind of counting on it, huh? But
his life will be easier if he's got theoretically the same parallel from his days in Massachusetts.
Oh, of course.
One of his finest accomplishments as governor, he has to run away from.
Absolutely,
nomination.
Yeah. So let me ask you then about, you just mentioned the Supreme Court clerks. I recently did a UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood, and Lawrence Lessig, the law professor from Harvard, was our guest, and he clerked for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And I asked him about what he thought was going to happen with Citizens United and whether this Montana case could, because a couple of the justices, I think Ginsburg and Breyer, suggested that this might be an opportunity to revisit Citizens United. And Lawrence Lessig thought it could be actually quietly overturned.
I agree with that. I appreciated that in your note to me, I think Lessig is right on. I've been writing and tweeting about that Montana case since it first broke. It was ignored by the mainstream for almost a week or better when it came out, and I read it with fascination. They make a very compelling case that at least Montana's an exception. They looked right square at Citizens United, said, hey, doesn't apply. So they've pried a little hole through which the camel not only has his nose but might get his whole body in the tent. So I think Lessig is right. Incidentally, your listeners want to follow my Twitter account. It's at John W. Dean.
At John.
All are welcome.
Well, the logic of overturning it, I mean, listen, my understanding is that, of course, it will be the vote of again the vote that prevailed in the case that we started talking about today, Justice Anthony Kennedy.
Yeah, he's a swing vote. He actually is. It's a one man court right now.
It's a one man court, right? So my understanding is that at least this is what Lawrence Lessig told me. He said that he thinks that first of all, I asked him what were they thinking? Because remember, when the president in the State of the Union castigated the court. Alito mouthed, you're wrong or not true. I think not true was the words. What were they thinking? And I guess the idea is that somehow they were equating the rights of a documentary filmmaker and vast and powerful corporations. And now the evidence is so manifest that is completely out of balance, even if they were motivated by their sort of purity over the First Amendment. He felt that the evidence is so manifest out there that the four conservatives may not, they're pretty rigid, but Kennedy may literally recognize reality.
Yeah, I think there is a real possibility of that. And what's interesting is if you recall the debate we had at your forum on Citizens United at the time it was handed down, I predicted exactly what's happening would happen, as most of the people who weren't idealistically ideologues on this issue had to agree that unlimited corporate funds were on their way in. And I said the first year they will hide and they will very low profile it. Then the next time year round, they're coming in because once they understand the playing field, like you've never seen them before, and here they are. And it's totally distorting American politics. I mean, the amount of money that's going to be raised in this presidential election is just unseemly.
Well, it seems like it it could determine the outcome just by sheer volume, and there doesn't seem to be any limit to the sheer volume.
No, it could well. Obama's had found himself, as much as he dislikes Citizens United and the unregulated PACs that they're able to create, he's got to do it to play the game, or he will be outspent and the office will be perched right out from underneath him.
Well, he's at a disadvantage because there's an awful lot more jaundiced billionaires than there are idealistic ones.
Well, fortunately, there's some idealistic millionaires around, too. There are a lot more people who will pony up a couple dollars that will support Obama than Romney or he being the most likely can garner.
Well, with the two big pockets billionaires, the guy that owns Progressive Insurance and George Soros have both said this time around they're sitting it out, so... We can see how much money is pouring in, and even into Gingrich and Santorum, let alone when they finally choose somebody.
It is ugly out there.
And this is only the primary, so the general, you'd have to assume that infinitely more money is going to pour in.
It's going to be a $1 billion election.
Wow. So John Dean, in terms of this election, though, a lot of pundits are saying, particularly when, I think it's less likely now that Santorum will be able to, maybe he could last through California, but it seems more and more likely that Romney will eventually become the nominee, albeit not without some bruising to the party. The analogy, though, that's often used is that this could be another Goldwater convention like the 64 blowout.
Well, if Romney didn't move to the center, if he gets the nomination, then you'd see that situation. Romney will flip-flop whichever direction he smells the wind or feels the wind blowing, and he'll try to get in front of it. Santorum, however, who I do not believe will get the nomination, and certainly not Gingrich, that would be a potential Goldwater redo, like 64. And, I think it would be the greatest thing for Obama. It would certainly ease his pain, because Romney will run to the center as soon as he gets the nomination, whereas Santorum would not. And it'd be a very real test of what kind of power conservatism has. I don't think it, you know, I don't think that it can really generate much more than 40-50% most. But you're going to need more than that to, I'd say 40% most, really, of the voters. And that's a lot of them holding their nose to just support the party.
Well, but that's just in closing. The what is the party now? It's so, moved so far to the right that traditional Republicans like yourself are you know an extinct species.
Well, we're not Republicans.
Right. So where's your home? Where do you go?
We're independent. We have none, but we control who wins.
I see. I said, well, we better stay in touch then.
we're like Kennedy on the court. We're the swing vote.
Right. Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, John Dean.
Thanks, Ian.
Great. Bye. Again, I've been speaking with John Dean, who's the former counsel to Richard Nixon, and prior to that, he was chief minority counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the associate director of the Law Reform Commission, and associate deputy attorney general of the United States. Today, he's a best-selling author who writes on the law, government, and politics, and Justia, I think is the name of his column, justia.com. His latest book is Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive Branch, Legislative, and Judicial Branches. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with one of the key people who has been fighting the good fight against the Keystone XL pipeline.